I'm sure that it's just a sign of my age, but one of the favorite shows around our house is the Antiques Roadshow. Now that I am one, it even means more to me than ever. But seriously, for those who love history, are fascinated by old things on whatever level, it's a very interesting show. It's put out by the Public Broadcasting Network, or at least that's what it appears on. And it's actually modeled after a show that's been running much, much longer over in England on their networks over there, the BBC and so forth, also called the Antiques Roadshow. And wouldn't you know it, my wife discovered not only can we watch the Antiques Roadshow American on PBS, but our cable network carries a channel that carries also the British one. So we get to watch the British one along with the American one. But I only want to mention that, and we've talked about this before, that one of the important things in these shows, and of course people are bringing in all sorts of things, maybe someone has an old gun or an old sword or an old piece of furniture or an old toy or almost anything imaginable as long as it fits the category of old. And they want to know if it's collectible, if it's has some value to it. Do people think that it's important enough because of both of its age and what it is and where it came from, that some value can be assigned to it? And, of course, I think we all have this little bit of vicarious nature about us that we like to think, wow, they found this old thing in a garage sale and paid a dollar for it, and now they're telling them it's by some famous artist and it's worth $200,000. And we'd like to sort of imagine that maybe that would happen to us someday. Probably not. In fact, of course, those things are carefully edited. All the people who showed up with stuff that was worth absolutely nothing are never featured on the show. It's only those few who actually did have something that was of some significant value. But the thing they emphasize over and over in this show, whether it's the English or the American version of it, is what they call the provenance. Now, provenance is just a fancy word for the history and the evidence that allows them to know what this thing really is and whether it's genuine or not. So for whatever reason, every once in a while, especially on the British show, someone will have a beautiful piece of pottery and the expert will be looking at it and he'll talk all about how this piece of pottery like this was originally made maybe in the 1730s through the 1750s, and it was made just in this particular place, either over in Europe or there on the mainland of England itself, and was highly collectible and so forth. And then he'll say, but because this was so popular, back in the early 1900s, over in Belgium or over in the Netherlands, there was a shop that started up over there mass producing fake copies of this. And you've got a fake. And it's worth about what you paid for it at the garage sale, $5. And so we mention all of this and this whole idea of provenance because when we're talking about what we are right now, these documents that make up our New Testament, what we're calling for the sake of this study, the Jesus documents, because it's only from the New Testament documents, Matthew through Revelation, that we know about Jesus and we know about what he came to do and we know about the church and we know about God's will for us and for the world. And so as we talk about these documents that now are almost 2,000 years old, we're talking about the provenance. What about the originals? How did these documents, as they were copied and transmitted, how did they come down to us? How can we have confidence that what we have is in every essential the same as what was originally written by the first authors? Whether it was Matthew, or Mark, or Luke, or Paul, or Peter, or Jude, how can we have that confidence? And of course, because of this skepticism that's existed for hundreds and hundreds of years by those who are unbelievers, the unbeliever is often poking at us as believers and saying, you can't believe, you can't trust that what you have is what was originally written. And of course, they make all sorts of attacks on our faith. And it's kind of interesting, even with those so-called experts, many of them even will contradict each other in the claims they will be making. Some will say, yes, we know Jesus really lived, but these documents aren't accurate records of his life. Others will say, we don't even believe he lived, and this whole thing is a charade or just based on myth and legend and fake documents and so forth. And still others will say, yes, he lived, and these documents originally were about him, but then they got changed and so forth over the centuries. And so they don't even agree with each other. But it all makes headlines, doesn't it? They'll always be on the same network with Antiques Roadshow. There'll be some documentary on some, quote, latest discovery that supposedly questions in a serious way whether or not either Jesus or these documents are what we've always believed them to be, or it'll be over on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel or somewhere. And then there'll be books and there'll be headlines in the newspapers and it'll be on the 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock news and all of that. And then a few weeks or months later, we never hear from him. All it was, all it is, are arrows from the evil one trying to inflict a wound upon the faith of some. And once they've done their little bit with that, they abandon it. That's the amazing thing to me. If we were to go back 20 years and look at some of the attacks that were going on against the Bible and against the faith of believers, just 20 years ago, you would scarcely find anyone today who would want to defend any of those accusations that were made just 20 years among unbelieving scholars, I'm talking. They've already abandoned it themselves. It really raises the question whether they even believed it themselves when they were attacking. But we need to be secure in our faith. We need to be confident. In spite of what we will sometimes hear in the media and its various forms, that what we do have is in fact a reliable, dependable record of Jesus and his teachings and what God wants us to know. And so right now we're in that section of this of talking about what's called the transmission or the preservation of the documents. And it shouldn't be a secret to anyone, because this is what we know at this present time, that we do not have any of the original manuscript. What we mean by that is we don't have the original writing by Paul, for example, of Romans. We don't have the original writing of Matthew by Matthew. What we have are copies. It was expected from the very beginning, not just with the Jesus documents, but most documents of any consequence in ancient times, that the original would be copied, and that the vast majority of people would ever only know about the copy, not the original. That never raised a question in their mind about whether there was an original or even what had happened to it, as long as they had confidence that the copy they had was a faithful reproduction. We're still that way today. I don't know if you realize this or not, but when Abraham Lincoln went to Gettysburg a few months after that tremendous and tragic battle that took place during our American Civil War, when he went there for them to dedicate that particular plot of ground to a national memorial for the men on both sides, the North and the South, who died at that battle, and he gave that speech called the Gettysburg Address, that what we normally call the Gettysburg Address is not what he originally wrote down on a piece of paper. Did you realize that? In fact, we're not even sure if we have that original piece of paper. What we have is a reporter sitting in the audience as he gives that brief speech 47 years ago, our forefathers, a reporter sitting in the audience taking shorthand, writing down as quickly as he could what Lincoln was saying, and then immediately rushing back after the ceremony was over and having that telegraphed back to his newspaper so it could be published in the newspaper. That is what we have for the Gettysburg Address. Does anyone believe that Lincoln did not, in fact, make that speech? Does anyone believe that what we have is not in all essentials, substantially, exactly what he said? No. I don't think you'll find a historian anywhere who would believe that. And yet we don't have the original. And what we actually have is not even a copy. What we have is what a man heard Lincoln say, and him writing it down and then having it telegraphed which means someone else is copying it by means of telegraph off to the newspaper. And then when they receive it, they take that telegram that they have and then they transfer it in type into the newspaper so it can be published the next day. What do we have? We have copies of copies of copies. But no one questions the accuracy or the value of it. Now, a couple of years later, or over a year later, Lincoln was asked about the speech and whether or not what was actually put into the newspaper was accurate. And then he was asked, would he be willing to submit his own copy of it? So he sat down and, based on his memory, wrote out what he said over a year before, and that's what he gave to the publisher of a book who was putting together a book of great speeches by great Americans that was then published after Lincoln was already dead. Even he didn't have the original. Or if he did, he didn't submit that to the publisher to go into this book. But what he, from memory, remembered later. And it is different a little bit in some ways from the one that appeared in the newspaper. He changed a few words. He added a word or two. Does that mean it's not accurate? We can't depend on it? We should just cut it out of our history books and say we can't believe this is true? Not at all. And I realize some of us perhaps aren't comfortable talking about things having to do with history and didn't realize this is how history works. And so it's not at all casting aspersion or doubt upon what we have. In fact, it sort of sets the scene for us to see how reliable and dependable what we have actually is. So the originals were written. They claimed to be by eyewitnesses, by these four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Luke, the only one who doesn't ever claim that he actually saw Jesus himself, but rather knew people who had been disciples and followers of Jesus in that first generation. And he carefully interviewed them and collected from them this information and put it together in his gospel. But then there was the Apostle Paul, who grew up in Jerusalem, the very place that these things were going on with Jesus. And then later he became a convert to Christianity, even though at first he believed it was fake. Not that he believed it was fake. He believed that Jesus was a blasphemer and that these people who followed him therefore were blaspheming against the Jewish religion until he became convinced it was in fact true. And then the other writers of our New Testament. If you attend or ever have attended our Thursday night classes we have here with the Tanglewood Bible Institute, you know, we have this complete set of courses we teach on Thursday night, 40 of them, taught pretty much on a college level about every book of the Bible, either specifically or in a survey form, as well as many other subjects, like right now we're doing Christian counseling as part of our Thursday night program. But one of the courses we've already done at least twice is one called Historical Christian Evidences by one of our instructors up at Sunset, where I work during the week. And he, a number of years ago, wrote a book which he says nothing original in. It's only what many, many others have already said. And in that book that he wrote, he has a little chart. So I went and pulled this out of Don's library just before church began, or as it was beginning. And in there is a chart about some very important ancient document that any student of the classics, as they're called, historical classics, would recognize. Things like, the writings of the ancient philosophers, the writings of some of the ancient historians like Thucydides and Herodotus, or even some of the writings by some of the famous emperors like Julius Caesar, who wrote up from his own memory and maybe notes a volume of books in around 50 BC called the Gallic Wars, in which he talked about his conquest of France and northern Spain and even his attempt to conquer Britain. These ancient books are sort of the foundation of much of what we know of ancient history, at least in Europe and Asia Minor and North Africa, even today. Our history books today depend on these books to tell us about history from this period of time, from anywhere from 400 or 500 BC right on up to 100 or 200 AD. Very dependent on these books. And this little chart that Brother Wharton has put together, he points out, for example, the history of Thucydides, which covers a lot of the history of going on in Asia Minor as well as in early history of Greece, was written around 400 BC. That's 400 years before Jesus was born. But the earliest copy we have of the history of Thucydides comes from 900 AD. In other words, even though he wrote this series of books in 400 B.C. talking about history up until his time in his part of the world, and it was written, and maybe very early on copies were made of it by others, it's not until 900 A.D., 1,300 years later, that we have our earliest copy of it. So for 1,300 years, it was copied, we don't know how many times, and copied, until finally a copy was made that survived until our time. Very similar with the history of Herodotus, written around 450 B.C. Again, the earliest copies we have around 900 A.D. Or even Caesar's Gallic Wars, I mentioned a while ago. Most of what we know about Julius Caesar come from only two or three sources, and a major part of what we know about his conquest of Western Europe as he was extending what would soon become the Roman Empire, would switch from the Republic to the Empire, comes from these writings by him of the Gallic Wars. He wrote those around 50 B.C., but the earliest copy we have is in 850 A.D., 900 years later. Should we therefore say, well, these are just so separated from the originals and the copies and copies of copies that we just can't believe he really conquered Western Europe and he didn't really conquer France and Northern Spain and attempt to conquer Great Britain and so forth? No historian takes that position. So you get the point already? That just we just mentioned three documents here, ancient books, and yet anywhere from 900 to 1,300 years separate us from the first from when it happened to the first copies we have. And again, this falls in this area, like we said, of what's called provenance, of what's the history of it. But then we go to our documents, the Jesus documents. Here they are. They start being written before A.D. 50. The first of them, for sure, like the first letters of the Apostle Paul are written as early as A.D. 45, A.D. 46, something like that. And he dies in A.D. 63 or 64. And so all of his epistles, letters from Romans down through Philemon, all had to have been written in that period of time. Then we have the Gospels. Mark is thought to have been written maybe around 55 A.D. or A.D. 55. Matthew, maybe. Different scholars take slightly different positions because there's no date in the book itself about it. Anywhere from A.D. 65 to A.D. 75. Luke was a companion, a traveling companion of Paul's, and so he almost surely wrote his gospel while Paul was still alive and he was traveling with him, which would put it around A.D. 60 or A.D. 60. And John, even Christian history tells us that John wrote his later than the others, and there's things inside the book that seem to hint it. And so that would maybe put it the last of them, A.D. 80, A.D. 85. Well, how long a time exists between when the originals were written, whether it's A.D. 46 or A.D. 85, and by then you've got all 27 of them written. How long between when they were written and the first copies? 900 years, like Caesar's Gallic Wars? 1,300 years, like Thucydides' history? 1,350 years, like the history of Herodotus? The earliest copy we start having of any of them actually starts with the last one written, at least of the Gospels. We don't know exactly when John was written, A.D. 80, A.D. 85. The earliest copy we have of a portion of the Gospel of John, A.D. 120, 45 years. And that's not speculation, that's proven. It's a very small piece of a copy of John. So small it only has four verses on it. Two verses on the front side and two verses on the back side. It's all that's left of obviously a much larger document. But it can be proven beyond any reasonable doubt that this is a copy. At least it's part of what was originally a copy and only a small piece. And they can date accurately within 5 years approximately of when it went into the trash heap that it was found in because of all the other things that are in that trash heap at the same time as it. Found in northern Egypt by archaeologists over 100 years ago. But we don't stop with that. We find by A.D. 200, we have copies of a document called the Papyrus Bodmer II, also designated by P65. These are all technical terms that's beyond most of us. But it's dated to A.D. 200, which puts it just somewhere between 100 and at most 150 years after the originals, this document contains almost all of the Gospel of John in it. Not 900 years after the original, but only 150 years after the original. Then there's what's often referred to as the Chester Beatty Papyri, because this was the historian and archaeologist who originally discovered it. It is actually made up of portions of 12 different books. And by books, we don't mean books of the Bible, but rather the way the volumes were originally bound, also dated to about AD 200. In it is found portions of, and even the greater part of, all four of the Gospels, the book of Acts, almost all of Paul's letters, along with the book of Hebrews and the book of Revelation. Again, just somewhere between 120 to 150 years after the original manuscript, not 1300. And these are only three examples out of, over the next several hundred years, all before you ever get as far out as 900 years from the originals, we have over 5,300 of portions or all of the books of our New Testament, all within 900 years. As compared to almost any other document, in fact, I think it's safe to say, and scholars will say, as compared to any other document of ancient history, the documents that make up our New Testament are beyond question in terms of whether or not we have reliable copies. And that's just the copies of the manuscripts themselves. There's two other threads of evidence that weave into this as well. Let me mention those to you briefly here. And that is that not only were copies being made of these documents almost from the time they were first written, but it wasn't very long because of the nature of the gospel and the fact that they were reaching out and carrying this message to people who didn't speak the Greek language that these documents were originally written in, that it's not long before they're starting to translate these documents into other languages. And why that's important is, number one, you can't translate something that doesn't exist yet, okay? There was a group of scholars 100 years ago who argued that none of the New Testament documents go back as far as 200 A.D., well, that argument doesn't hold up in light of newer discoveries, but it also doesn't hold up in light of the fact that portions of the New Testament were already translated into two other languages, and we have these translations into the other languages, and they both date back to around AD 150. So how can you translate something into another language if you're busy saying it didn't even exist yet? And so by about AD 150, at least the Gospels were already translated and copies were already being made. So we don't know actually when the translation took place, but copies were already being made, and we have some of those copies translated into the Syriac language. Remember in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, that as the gospel spread out, one of the places that had a great impact was a place called Antioch of Syria. In fact, it says in Acts chapter 11 that the disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. And then it was a little bit later from Antioch that the church there selected from their own number a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus and a man who was working with him who had come up from Jerusalem by the name of Barnabas to go out and preach the gospel. Went to the island of Cyprus and then went up to what today is Turkey and traveled around through there, what we now label in our Sunday school material as the first missionary journey of the Apostle Paul. But the church in Antioch sent those men out on that first journey and sent Paul out on his second journey and sent him out on his third journey. And so at some point very early on, because many of the people who lived in and around Antioch, Greek was their second language. Their native tongue was what was called Syriac. And so by AD 150, we already have copies of the Gospels in the Syriac language. It's already been translated out of Greek into Syriac, and copies of it are being made for people to have. And not only that, we also have copies of portions of our New Testament already translated by AD 150 into the Latin language. For who ruled the world at that time? Not Greeks, even though Greek was the universal language of the Roman Empire. The Romans did. And what was their native language? Latin. And so by AD 150, we have Latin translations of portions of our New Testament. And then by the time you move forward just another 100 years, we find also translations into the Coptic language, the language of Egypt. in New Testament times and afterwards in the Armenian language, which is a language of parts of what is today modern Turkey, and the Georgian language, which Georgia today is a part of what was once the USSR, the Soviet Union, the southern, sort of the southwest corner, the old Soviet Union. So by AD 250, we already have portions or all of the New Testament, even in the fragments and copies we have today of these books already translated into these other languages and themselves being copied over and over again for people. And so not only do we have these copies of the originals and copies of the original, but we have translations already taking place. Then a third thread that weaves in to make this rope ever stronger is we have a large number of documents written by early Christian leaders in the church. These are often referred to by historians, the earliest group of them, called the Apostolic Fathers. They're called that because these were men who lived close enough to the New Testament time that they either could have, or in fact some did, actually know an apostle. While they were very young men, perhaps, they had met or known an apostle, or at least lived within one lifetime of them. So they're called the Apostolic Fathers. The Apostolic Fathers cover from about A.D. 90 up to about A.D. 160. The last of them we know of was a man by the name of Polycarp of Smyrna. Smyrna was a city in Asia, located very close to Ephesus. Polycarp was burned at the stake in the A.D. 160s because as a very old man and a leader in the church in Smyrna, he would not renounce his faith in Jesus. He himself says in his writings that have survived that he, when he was a very young man, had sat at the feet of John, spent the last years of his life in Ephesus before being exiled to the Isle of Patmos. Whether he died there or not, we don't know, but that was at the very end of his life, nevertheless. And Polycarp knew. And now as a very old man into his 80s, he's burned at the stake, the local authorities, because he would not renounce his faith in the truth. And so those are the Apostolic Fathers. And as they die out, the new men just call the early church fathers. And so we have hundreds and hundreds of writings by them that have survived. And what do we find in their writings? We find them referring to the writings of the apostles. We hear them talking about what the apostles and first followers of Jesus had said and written down. We even find them quoting from them. In fact, scholars have said, I don't have any way of independently verifying this, but I've seen it numerous times said, that if you take all the church fathers who lived from A.D. 90 up to around A.D. 300, and you go through all of their writings, and you pull out all of their quotes in which they're quoting from Matthew or one of the letters of Paul or whatever, and put them all together, you will have, excepting only just a very few verses, our entire New Testament just from their quotation. How can they be quoting from that which didn't yet exist? Not only that, these men lived everywhere, so to speak. Some of them lived all the way over in Spain. Some lived in Rome. Many of them lived in what is today Turkey, whether in Ephesus or Smyrna or one of the other cities of that area where the church was very strong. Some of them lived in Antioch. Some of them lived down in Egypt, like in Alexandria. And somehow all of them had copies of one part or other of what we now call our New Testament, and they're quoting from it as authority. As we had read at the beginning of our service this morning, as it says there in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul, writing to the church there at the very beginning in Ephesus, said concerning them that they were built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, the whole thing that held it together. Well, 100 years later, 150 years later, 250 years later, that's still what the church was all about. It was being built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets because they were using these documents that had been made back there in that first century by the eyewitnesses, and there has been widely distributed all around the Roman Empire through all these churches. And they're teaching it, and they're preaching it, and they're writing it, they're quoting it, they're referring to it. It is honestly unparalleled in history to see any other set of documents being not only copied and distributed this way, but the kind of influence they were having in their ancient world. Nothing that was written by the Roman historians, nothing that was written by the emperors themselves, nothing that was written by the philosophers or the teachers of their day came anything close to the kind of pervasive coverage that these early documents that we still have today were having in those first 200 years. And this is in spite of the fact that Christianity itself was illegal as a religion. And while many times Rome and the Roman Empire had other more important things to do than to persecute Christians, nevertheless, they did devote a good deal of attention and time to persecuting them. And one of the very centers of their persecution was if you had a copy of one of the, quote, sacred writings of Christianity, you were subject to arrest and instant death. And so during this same period of time, while these copies are being made and men are quoting from them and everything else, regularly the Roman Empire, the Roman emperors, would institute these persecutions in which they would literally go house to house to people they believed to be Christians and search their houses to see if they had in their possession a copy of any portion of what was considered the sacred writings of the Christians. That means even the Romans knew what counted and what didn't count. And so if you or one of the elders in your congregation, maybe in Smyrna like Polycarp, or even in Rome itself like Clement of Rome in AD 96, if you had a copy of any of these sacred writings, you were arrested. The document was confiscated and it was burned. I said a while ago, we have some 5,300 copies of early Christian documents that make up our 27. I wonder how many we'd have if the Romans hadn't been so diligent for over 200 years to take all they could and burn. That's how many we have with them doing that. I wonder how many we'd have if they hadn't done that. In other words, the Roman Empire was trying to stamp out Christianity by stamping out the books that they had, knowing that that was the source of these people's faith. That was the source of their confidence that what they believed was true, was these copies of the originals that they had. And so they destroyed them, they burned them, they did everything within their power to eliminate it. And yet, they were unsuccessful. And what we have today, almost literally, are blood-stained copies that Christians long before us gave their lives to protect, defend, and copy and pass on so we could have them. How confident can we have? How much confidence can we have that what we have today is reliable and dependable? Well, we're no experts ourselves. We can quote from those who are. We find, for example, from a great manuscript expert from the middle of the last century, the 1900s, by the name of F.F. Bruce, and I'm reading out of his little book called The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? He says, about the middle of the last century, it was confidently asserted by a very influential school of thought that some of the most important books of the New Testament, including the Gospels and the Acts, did not exist before the 30s of the second century. This conclusion was a result not so much of historical evidence as of philosophical presuppositions. But the amount of evidence available in our own day is so much greater and more conclusive that a first century date for most of the New Testament writings cannot reasonably be denied, no matter what our philosophical presuppositions must be. He says, we do not quarrel with those who want more evidence for the New Testament than for other writings. Firstly, because the universal claims which the New Testament makes upon mankind are so absolute, and the character and works of its chief figure, Jesus, in other words, are so unparalleled that we want to be as sure of its truth as we possibly can. And secondly, because in point of fact, there is much more evidence for the New Testament than for any other ancient writings of comparable date. That's only just a small portion by him. And at the end of this particular chapter, he quotes another person considered by many even more influential than him, a man by the name of Sir Frederick Kenyon, who established basically the whole wing of the British Museum that is filled with ancient documents and manuscripts, not just of the Bible, but of ancient history in general, and then oversaw it for more than 30-something years as they built it up and he curated it and everything. But Sir Frederick Kenyon said, the interval between the dates of the original composition and the earliest extant evidence, and he's talking about for the New Testament, become so small as to be in fact negligible, and the last foundation for any doubt that the Scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. But he's saying, by whatever reasonable standard you would use to measure whether or not we have substantially the same as the originals or not, and whether or not we can depend upon them to be accurate or not, whatever standard you use that any historian or scholar would use, all doubts have been removed. Now, sometimes Christians even ask, if these things are in fact from God, why didn't he do more to preserve them? What more would you wish for him to do? He's already done more than any other ancient document can claim. There is, in fact, no other set of documents before AD 1400 even. That's 1400 years after the New Testament itself, that are better preserved or more accurately copied than these. We can put our trust and faith in them. If any documents have come down to us from ancient times that we can believe in, these are the one, far more than any other. We can know that they are recording for us that which is trustworthy and reliable. Then the question really becomes, what are you going to believe what they said? Are you going to believe what history now has put its stamp of approval on? That in fact there was a person named Jesus who did miracles, who taught revolutionary things, who was unique and one of a kind of all who lived, and who said, only way to God. People may still choose not to believe that, but they can't do it on the basis of history. They can't do it on the basis of saying, we can't know if he really said that or not. We can't believe it because we don't know if he really did miracles or not. Some people say, well, I don't believe in miracles because miracles are impossible. Well, does that prove that miracles don't happen? Only that somebody's already made their mind up and nothing would plenty of people who say they had never believed in something because they believe it's impossible, and it turns out it's very possible. Just like those who say, I don't believe men walked on the moon because it's impossible for us to get from here to the moon. Does that prove that, in fact, no one went to the moon? Neil Armstrong didn't walk on the moon along with two or three others? Well, that doesn't prove it at all. It just means some people have already made up their mind. They're not going to listen to the evidence. But what about us? We can believe.